You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is, for better or for worse, June 3rd of 2020. And the United States is burning, largely because of the media's constant stoking of this sort of thing for the last, 30 years. I mean, at least. I remember the Rodney King violence, the edited video, the manipulation of information, the deliberate stoking of anti-white violence. And in fact, that case in 1992 was one of the things that changed my world. For the first time, I saw media actively doing everything in their power to hurt, murder white people. I'm never comfortable with racial categories, never have been. But when they're rammed down your throat every day, sometimes quite literally, you have no other choice. But all of these mawkish and maudlin calls for peace are just, it's just middle-class hand-wringing. You know, there's no leadership, there's no ideology, there's no beliefs. It's pure abulia, and all they really know how to do is repeat some slogans from the McGovern campaign in 72. I remember, well, today, of course, you know, I remember the narrative. It's the same narrative over and over and over again. I guess the jogger and the work boots didn't quite take it. And so they invented this one. This is a very, very strange one. Right away, I noted that there's a in the actual case of this guy killing this counterfeiter, whatever the heck it was. There's a vanity plate on the police car that says "police" on it. I don't know if you've ever seen that before. There can only be one of them. It's not a normal police license plate. It's a vanity plate that says police on it. I've never seen that before. It's not a normal municipal plate. That was one thing I noticed. Another thing I noticed is that this is all out in the open. The police is looking right into the camera, knowing full well what's going on. And they know each other. And of course, you know, the script was released and no one ever bothered to ask these questions. But this isn't really critical thought. It's just thought. Nothing makes any sense here. We know, of course, that rioting has always been the tool of the regime. We've all read the reports of the pallets of bricks that show up in the middle of nowhere where there's no construction. No one can explain why there are these police cruisers full of weapons that are just in the middle of nowhere and, you know, get ransacked. And, of course, as always, the police were told not to fight back, and so people were killed, and white people are now being targeted for being white. That was never the case for Black America. That was always, you know, these were criminals. Every one of these cause celebs are vile animals, from Rodney King on down. These aren't, this isn't Duke Ellington here that they're talking about. They're the lowest of their community. Rodney King was pulled over because he was beating the crap out of his girlfriend. That was cut out of the narrative. When Stacey Coon wrote his tell-all biography, presumed guilty, you would think that mainstream publishers would be screaming for it. You know what would sell? No, it had to be published by Regenry. No one would touch it. And no one even knows who, what his point of view is. But I distinctly remember that 1992, I saw that full unedited video and no one ever saw it again. Of course, the police were more than justified in what they did. Anyway, when this virus hit, regardless of any questions about its origin or purpose, it was a economic phenomenon. But I'm sick and tired of this now. Obviously, the regime suddenly has discovered that protesting is perfectly okay when they're non-white, or at least supporting a non-white cause. But when we were in the street just a few weeks ago, we were irresponsible. We were going to kill thousands of people. The only good thing is coming out of this, of course, is the radicalization of our people and the complete unbridgeable chasm between the media and ordinary human beings. But all of this comes down to one concept, and that is that this is about economics. Then 48 hours after the announcement of the lockdown, I remember that one of the first news items was a massive bailout of Wall Street companies. If you guys remember, and I have quotes from the Financial Times, from the Guardian, last year talking about how wonderful the economy is, that this is a record expansion. Within a few months, Wall Street was collapsing. This is 48 hours into the lockdown. Well, there was only a handful of people saying that we were in a depression. I was saying this a year ago. I was saying this 2 years ago. I was saying this 5 years ago. I was saying it a tiny handful of others, Paul Craig Roberts, a handful of others, with any knowledge of economics at all, were saying everything, of course, they're saying now. And very little of the trillions that have been permitted into the economy have actually gotten to ordinary people. Only about $150 billion have gone to states for relief. And as we've said somewhere else, this is earmarked. The states can only spend this money on certain things, non-budget items, which is what really what they need. And how hilarious is it to watch Mitch McConnell and these idiotic fiscal conservatives who have no problem with giving trillions to their friends, and they are personal friends, but then get all angry when someone talks about expanding Medicare or being more generous on public works. They get outraged. This is the financial oligarchies I've been saying my entire career, which is now exoteric and out in the public. Just think of it like this. Banks now have minimal reserve requirements. They have minimal capital requirements. Given the nature of interest rates today, banks can now borrow for free. But how much are you paying on your credit card? It is pure profit on something that actually doesn't exist, and that's money. It's something that they, you know, hit return on the keyboard and that's it. And they don't even have to do that. Money exists because people believe it. It does. This is the whole nature of postmodernism. I have several papers on Baudrillard and Foucault. You know, the object in nominalism is the only thing that exists, but postmodernism very quickly removes the object, and now you only have the word. That's all that it is. It's images. It's sounds. Well, who controls that? It's a tiny handful of people. The last thing I'm going to say about this particular issue, and there's really not much to say, all they have to do is see what's going on, is that everything here we have predicted. Everything here we have been predicting for 20 years or more, precisely in this way. And somebody put on YouTube, I made a prediction in April on this show saying that the regime is going to start using racial issues to get violence out in the street to keep people home. I said this in April. It's on YouTube, my prediction. I said, because you have an oligarchy that is now open and you know, declaring itself as such. With Bill Gates, you know, making policy somehow. You're going to need things to keep people distracted and off balance. And race, I said something like they're gonna massacre a couple black kids on a playground or something like that, and that's what's gonna cause it. Well, they use it. I predicted this. Most of my predictions come true. This was pretty blatant because it was only a short time ago that I said they're gonna use racial violence because the bailout, the economy, is so blatant, the massive simply giveaway of trillions of dollars to a handful of Wall Street firms, without any restrictions. The handful of dollars that are given to ordinary people have nothing but restrictions, and most of us haven't received it. The states have only received about 5% of what they were given. This is a class issue as much as anything else. Now, on to something of more intellectual substance. I want to finally finish my talk on Montenegro. And if there's one thing I know how to do, I could connect anything to anything in history. Students have been saying that to me since I was in my 20s. Because Montenegrins are like the Cossacks. They are this mountain people who are fiercely independent, but still communal because this is the extended family, fanatically Orthodox, who are some of the physically strongest, most adaptable people who have ever come into existence. They are undefeatable. They're invincible in warfare. And even the Turks, you know, they couldn't get their cavalry up the mountains. What do you do? I've had entire lectures on this network, Ivan Selka, which I did a few years ago, how he personally had destroyed 3 Turkish armies. And for some reason, the Russians held him back from going straight into Istanbul. He was on the verge of liberating the holy city of Constantinople. Somehow he was arrested until they needed him again, and they brought him back. I have an entire lecture on that, but this is the threat that these kind of people hold. You have a true culture, an Orthodox and communal culture, against the settled bureaucratic state. Unfortunately, the bureaucratic state tends to win eventually, either by violence or by buying people off. The Montenegro is one of the most interesting things. Very few people know anything about it, so Johnson's Law is always applicable. There have been a few attempts, but these are heroic peoples. And I've done my best to trace at least the ideological foundations of their life from early modernity to, and we're talking now, I think we ended last time somewhere in the 1920s. And I spoke at some length about the unification idea. The idea that since Montenegrins, of course, are Serbs, in every way, linguistically, in every other way. Once the Serbian army rescued Montenegro from Austria-Hungary, that finally now they have the ability to join forces. And almost all of Europe, except Russia, flipped out. They cannot join together. Even though they're, you know, relatively small in numbers, together they will, of course, with Russian assistance, defeat all comers. And then we spoke a bit about Yugoslavia. And the only error that it contained was this naive belief that you could bring people of 2 different religious and therefore civilizational backgrounds together and expect something to happen. It's never been done. Religious unity is one of the absolute essential elements of success. When you have religious disunity, you have chaos. I mean, I don't have to talk about, you know, Austria-Hungary. I could talk about, you know, Lebanon. I could talk about Malaysia. I could talk about, you know, everywhere. Wherever you have religious disunity, basic civilizational principles. You can't have a nation. A nation is impossible on secular grounds. And you can't have a nation that is more than one religion, especially if those religions are fundamentally different. In Yugoslavia, you had many of them. You had Islam, of course, were held in contempt because most of these were Slavs who converted to avoid paying taxes and things like that. So they were the lowest of the low. You had Roman Catholics who want nothing to do with the Orthodox, especially at the time. Two completely different worlds. You had communists who introduced another religious point of view. You had Jews in cities like Salonika, who of course dominated the finance, even though there were like 10 of them. That's all they needed. And of course they had connections to the Fanar, which had a strong Jewish faction in Istanbul. And these people were supposed to work together, you know, and this mess, you had Lutherans in Slovenia. And I think the Germans always considered that really a part of southern Germany. And so it was doomed from the start and everyone knew it. There was this naive belief that somehow you could bring your Muslims and Roman Catholics in to a federation where the only really experienced diplomats and soldiers were all Serbs. You know, Serbs were the only ones who had a functional independent state, not only independent state, but a victorious one, one that took on all comers at a point of utter exhaustion and defeated Austro-Hungary in two invasions, despite being completely exhausted from the Balkan Wars before that. And I think the last thing we talked about was King Alexander's assassination in 1934. You need to remember that, you know, and I've said this elsewhere, Hitler and Mussolini were rarely ever actually allies. That's a myth. Mussolini was seen as an irritating footnote to Hitler, maybe even worse than that. More like a dust jacket that you kind of just take off and wish you could just throw away. Whatever he did caused Germany nothing but trouble. That's why he was in North Africa. That's why he was in the Balkans. And it was Italy that financed all of the movements that wanted to destroy Yugoslavia. The Ustasha was not a German creation whatsoever. It was an Italian creation with strong Hungarian backing. I have all the papers of the German High Command in Southern Europe, Southeastern Europe, and over again, they complain about Mussolini's interference, that the Ustasha are so violent and irrational that they're causing tremendous trouble for the German war effort, German supplies. Driving the Serbs out of Croatia and elsewhere, they created violence and they created a tremendous dislocation that Germany could ill afford. The SS commanders and others down there were constantly sending cables back to Berlin saying, essentially, get rid of Mussolini, because this is his doing. But Mussolini was working with Great Britain all the way up until the beginning of the war. And part of the problem there was England and France saw Mussolini as essential in controlling Yugoslavia, and hence Russian influence in the Balkans. Now, you had factions of, you know, leftists of all types, Croatian separatists of all types, Muslims, all targeting Belgrade with both Hungarian and Italian assistance. By 1929, there was almost a dissolution of the state. Liberalism was a miserable failure. Of course, the Depression had destroyed the European economy, with the exception of Germany. But even by 1929, that wasn't relevant. And there was a armed insurgence against Belgrade, financed to a great extent by Italy. And one of the things that we talked about was the Montenegrin Greens. Now, the Greens have nothing to do with environmentalism. frankly, I don't think environmentalism has anything to do with environmentalism. But Greens refer to a kind of a no vote, which was green colored, at the assembly that decreed the unity of Serbia and Montenegro. King Alexander established a dictatorship. And we mentioned this last time. I have books out defending the military dictators of Latin America. These things don't happen for fun. They don't happen because they're just seeking more power. They know the tremendous risks involved. It usually is a net loss for people like this. The state was falling apart. Political parties, to a great extent, were expressions of separatism. So either he bans the parties, or at least bargains with them, or he accepts the destruction of the state. Why did Yugoslavia exist? Yugoslavia existed because the small states of the Balkans by themselves were too weak to withstand the great powers, whether it be, you know, the Soviets, what was left of the Turks, certainly the Italians and Hungarians, and of course, as always, the imperialists farther west. And most of these groups were fully aware in the beginning that this is something that they needed to do. By themselves, they couldn't do it. But together, they couldn't do it either. So 1934, Alexander was assassinated by allegedly a Bulgarian nationalist. And of course, the rivalry between Mussolini and King Alexander had complicated Louis Barthou's work in France to contain Germany. This is one of the reasons that Mussolini was of great interest to the British and supported by the British because, and not an ally, never an ally of Hitler until, you know, the war began. And even that was, he was an ally. You know, he was a disaster. In terms of foreign policy, everything he touched was a disaster. I've dealt with him in the past. The Ethiopians almost beat him. They came very close to beating him. The only way that Mussolini was able to defeat the Ethiopian army was the use of poison gas. The point of Yugoslavia, at least from the point of view of the British, was you wanted a strong, prosperous state, southeastern Europe, to contain German expansion. Suddenly, Russia wasn't a problem anymore because it's now the Soviet Union. They're being financed, heavy industrial investment from the West. We've covered that elsewhere. So suddenly, Russia's not a problem anymore as far as London is concerned. There is no Russia anymore at the time. So Germany was the only thing now to contain. And this is one of the reasons that Britain was allied with Mussolini. And except the problem was Mussolini was splitting from this alliance over Yugoslavia. Containing Germany was a problem if Mussolini and France are going to bicker over Yugoslavia. There was too many port cities that the Italians wanted, that Mussolini wanted. Alexander said that there were attacks on him and attacks on his on Yugoslavia that were coming from Italy. And because of the interest of this alliance, it was permitted or at least tolerated by the French. Then, of course, Hungarian revisionism, for better or for worse, and both had created the or at least supported the Croatian separatist movement. And either the French tolerated it, accepted it, or pretended they didn't see it. So Barthou in France had this plan again for this anti-German alliance. And of course, Alexander noted. He mentioned to the French that hundreds of Croatian nationalists were being trained in Italy. And, you know, there were other assassination attempts against Alexander prior to the one that actually worked. Britain and France sided with Mussolini against Hitler and refused any blame to be placed on Mussolini for any of the extreme actions of the, whether it be the Greens or the Croatians or anything else. They protected him. You know, if I were the British at the time, I would really want Mussolini to ally with Hitler because that would be the end of him. Huge German losses were caused in North Africa and in the Balkan states because of Mussolini's incompetence. Any general, we talked about this elsewhere, any general that was successful, he immediately fired because he feared rivalry. Now, usually I don't like those kind of arguments about historical figures. We can't get inside people's heads. You can't claim that a ruler is jealous or a ruler is angry. That's absurd. That rarely is true, or at least relevant, except in Mussolini's case, because we know his personality. We know how he was, the crazy uniforms. But at the time, anyway, Britain and France were supporters of Mussolini in the sense that he could be used to control Germany. But Yugoslavia got in the way. One of the proofs that there was a tight control over the in the liberal states of the press was that any, the Balkans were front page news at the time, any blame placed on Mussolini was banned. Again, a ban doesn't have to be a paper signed by the prime minister. That's really not how it works. Power works differently in liberal states. Power is more private sectors slowly building a consensus and driving out dissenters. They may have a formal right to say something, to believe something. But if there's no place to say it, then it doesn't matter. That's something pretty much relevant today, of course. And of course, any newspaper in France that dared to blame Mussolini for anything that was going on was fined or shut down. Now, when Alexander was assassinated, again, front page news all over the world, Vlado Chernozemski was allegedly the killer that was established by the French police. But they also said that his group had been trained in Hungary, at least, which was a fact very damaging to French interests, because these guys had traveled to France on forged passports, and these guys, of course, were in constant communication with Ante Pavlović, the leader of the Ustasha living in Italy. So an operation like this, delicate and competently led as this, had to have interlocking intelligence support. These things are very difficult to pull off. The logistics is almost impossible, especially at the time. And this embarrassed the French government. So the Montenegrin Greens were these guys who, although small in number and defeated in election after election after election, they simply were unpopular. Because they fought to some extent the unification of Serbia and Montenegro, then joined this movement. Montenegrin Greens are, because they had been defeated so badly in the polls and elsewhere, they made alliances with whoever, you know, said a good thing to them. Sometimes with the communists, sometimes with the Croats, sometimes with the Muslims. They didn't care. If someone gave them money and said that they're relevant, they were in alliance with them. The communists promised them all kinds of things. Of course, they were wiped out the minute they came to power. But still, even though Hungary and Italy were implicated in the assassination, the French establishment refused to implicate the Hungarians and the Italian elites in this case. Now, as far as Serbia and Montenegro were concerned, as World War II dawned, the generation that survived the Balkan Wars was getting older. And a younger generation with really no context for cooperation with Serbia was coming up. And this group was often Western educated, recruited by both left and right to destroy the country. Now, Yugoslavia was really doomed from the start, despite, you know, its initial popularity. Remember, the carnage of World War I, it's kind of hard for us to have any context there. That was the issue. And to have a state that could maintain peace and protect its borders, something like Slovenia by itself could not do, was absolutely essential. And so they agreed to this, but, you know, the particulars were foggy and never solved. So in 1938, the Greens joined the United Opposition, which essentially was a Vlahomasic organization, united essentially the Yugoslav opposition, using slogans of abstract democracy, of course, as a cover. So the Montenegrin Federalists, really, as it turns out, are simply a foreign-funded agitating group. And as they became more and more marginalized, they became more and more radical. Initially, their views were pretty rational. As we said last time, They were against a unitary state, but they realized that we're all Serbs. And remember, you have mass slaughter. I mean, mass slaughter in the Balkan Wars and then World War I. The best of European manhood had been destroyed. And that's the context here. So they went from believing in some kind of federation to a so-called independent Montenegro. And you see that today. We talked about that several times. The only reason Montenegro exists as a separate country is because the EU forced it. And the minute they had numerous elections until they got the result they wanted, and then immediately put him under EU control. It's like the bait and switch with Kosovo. When Kosovo was claimed to be independent, and of course, this is what all the press idiots were reporting. No, it just meant that they came under EU control. They have no more independence than any city does, and than San Marino does. It's an EU protectorate. And the same thing goes for Montenegro. The only reason that even was an issue was to separate Serbs and keep them from fighting the EU in the Balkans. So generally speaking, the Montenegrin Greens supported the Croatian Party of Rights. And so you have this group of elite Serbs who became an anti-Serbian force, despite themselves. So eventually, as we all know, Yugoslavia had done very, very well so long as it connected itself to Germany. Once Hitler rebuilt the economy, we've dealt with the fact that military spending was not a factor. The German military was not well equipped in 1939. If you read Icebreaker and so many other works, Joachim Hoffmann, Hitler was in no position to do much of anything. Even by 1941, his armament production only really took off in 1944. He was not, the military buildup was very limited, despite what others will say. But the economic expansion, mostly driven by public works and using local money rather than foreign money for building the monetized system. Any country that attached itself to Germany economically and pegged its currency to the mark did very well. Therefore, Germany was popular. Germany was popular pretty much everywhere at the time because, again, they were an incredibly impressive economy, really a feat that's never been, given what Weimar was, it's never been duplicated anywhere. So eventually Yugoslavia had to be occupied by Axis forces for a whole bunch of reasons. One of them, of course, was the problem of the Ustasha. Now, I have papers and letters in my possession in several Serbian books. Actually, mostly English books, they're translations, talking about how these separatist groups were destroying all their plans. They couldn't get any rest because of both the Hungarian and Croatian movements. And now the Montenegrin Greens, though small in number, had money. And now they're a part of this. So now the Montenegrin Greens went explicitly to Rome and they collaborated with the Italian fascist movement in the area. I've argued many times Hitler was not a fascist. He did not agree with Mussolini on most of the ideological stuff he wrote in The Doctrine of Fascism. Because so few people could even define the term. People just assume Hitler was a fascist. He disagreed on the fundamentals of it. The Italian fascism was something unique to Italy. It was a purely secular idea. Elements of revolutionary nationalism and royalism could be found all over the world. You don't have to be in Europe in the 30s for that. But they, historians don't really know, and so they kind of throw them all into the same category of we don't like these guys. And so they use the fascist label, and that's pretty much what being a history professor in that era means. But the Montenegrin Greens are a case study because they didn't have a foundation. They didn't have a real purpose, except as a monkey wrench into the system. There were just one more grenade that the opponents of Yugoslavia can throw into the machinery. I've always been very ambiguous about Yugoslavia because you can't combine two different ethnic ideas, especially in this case, civilizational and religious ideas in one entity. The level of decentralization that you would need would make a federation absurd anyway. Of course, there was also the economic issue. Creating a common market and a common currency was in the interests of everyone involved. Again, if you were Slovenian or if you were Croatian, you really didn't have a civil service ready to go. You didn't have an army ready to go. The Serbs did. And that created a certain level of irritation. Now I have a book on Serbia, as you know, Heavenly Serbian, the Medieval Ideal, which I wrote a long time ago. I think it was when the Liberty Lobby went bankrupt, so that must have been maybe 2003, 2004. But the Montenegrin Greens is often removed from the treatments of the subject, especially during World War II, sided with Italy, which at the time didn't automatically mean an alliance with Germany. It's easy just to say, you know, Hitler and Mussolini were allies. I don't think they ever really were. The contempt that Hitler had for Mussolini, earlier in the 30s, the contempt that Mussolini had for Hitler was too extraordinary. And I believe Mussolini, you know, was always outclassed by pretty much anyone who stood next to, and was very, and knew what Hitler was as a politician, especially in the economic realm. He did whatever, you know, Mussolini tried to do. But unfortunately, you know, Italy was far more of a divided society than Germany, even Germany was. So, we talked a bit last time about the nature of the Montenegrin crown and Prince Nikola having this external Montenegrin government in exile. Again, financed either by the British or by the Italians. So, the Greens, who were cooperating with Mussolini, wanted a greater Montenegro, which sounds absurd, but really went from, you know, Herzegovina to Albania. It would include, you know, the Sandžak and Metohija, and, you know, it was really not a rational idea. And relying on Italian guns at the time was really an irrational idea because they never won anything. But in 1941, in July of 1941, there was a Kingdom of Montenegro proclaimed, much smaller than that crazy Greater Montenegro idea. At least they thought maybe this would bring peace because they wanted to satisfy the territorial claims of the Ustasha and the Albanians. At least possibly to have some peace so the Germans can build the area and move towards the Soviet Union, which of course, as I've said many times, the Germans were never in a position to invade properly. It was a suicide mission. By this time, of course, Germany occupies the Balkans to a great extent because of Mussolini's meddling, not really because they had any reason to. But Nicholas, his grandson and successor with Prince Michael, was invited to be head of state of this little kingdom, but he said, I'm not going to be involved with this occupation government. And certainly not with the Italian movement, the fascist movement in Croatia. The Germans were creating this, you know, ridiculous Greater Albania and Montenegro. You know, it was just simply this you know, tempest in a teapot as far as territory is concerned. But Germany needed to pay off its ally. But Italy was the last on its list, as always. Now, this is now the third time, as I've said before, that German guns needed to rescue Mussolini from his own incompetence. So once the Italian protectorate was proclaimed in the area, all political parties were outlawed. Jurjevic was the dictator, and this is really the only time the Greens had any kind of authority whatsoever. And of course, these territorial claims were never really solved. And the dynasty was never restored. And it didn't have a following anyway, because these are all Serbs and creating this, you know, bringing in foreign occupiers, whether it be Italians or Germans to support their claims was not popular, despite the fact that the German invasion was not voluntary. This is not something that they planned on. So it seems like you have a very small country now split into factions. But it's actually significant as far as European history at the time is concerned. The size of a nation or a region has absolutely nothing to do with its significance. But these, once you leave the national enclosure, especially in the Slavic world, you immediately lose who you are. And the Greens going back and forth from whether it be the Ústaše to the communists without any sense of irony is proof of this. So after supporting the Italian Ústaše occupation, they then oppose them by joining with the partisans. And they end up fighting the Chetniks, many of whom were pro-German, some of whom were anti-German. And now, of course, you have a civil war. Nothing had been solved. So the partisans stage an uprising in July, once this little state of Montenegro was proclaimed. They reorganize in Zagreb, Croatia, and the independent state of Croatia's capital. And so now you have this Serbian faction, allied, not only allied with the Croats, the Ústaše, but now having its offices right there in Zagreb. So they didn't know who they were going to sign. So then, by 1945, they side with the communists again. I mean, this gets absurd. The Balkans in World War II has not really been studied by, but certainly not by our people, but in general, there's so much work that needs to be done. Very little is in English. And so the factions upon factions upon factions eventually were dispersed in 1945. And really nothing was left of it. The minute the communists took over, despite all their promises, the Greens were killed by the partisans in 1945 because they were collaborators with the Italians. The leadership was wiped out by 1947. And the Greens were then wiped out entirely. Now, I spend a lot of time on them because it really shows it there's a lot of political lessons to be learned here. This group, as we said before, the faction of Montenegrins who refused to believe that they were Serbs for a whole bunch of reasons. And we talked about that elsewhere. They were defeated at the polls. They were humiliated militarily. They had a very narrow social base. They were really westernized people. They didn't belong there. And going from group to group to group showed that they had no ideology. They had no foundation. After a while, they just became a foreign pistol or a cudgel or a grenade. And they could be thrown or used whatever the Allies or the communists needed it. And finally, when someone takes over and ends all this chaos, they end up getting wiped out. And of course, this isn't uncommon. We know a thing or two about that in Western Europe since the war. But the Green idea was resurrected in the European Union. The sole reason it was resurrected was to keep Montenegro out of Russian hands. I've spent a lot of time talking about why Bulgaria and Romania, not to mention Montenegro, were brought into the European Union despite not satisfying a single requirement of membership. And it wasn't really talked about at the time. It was locally. But people who even follow this, it wasn't an issue. The European Union prided itself on a very strict series of both economic and political conditions. And these countries satisfied none of them. The only justification for it was that they had, especially Bulgaria and Montenegro, had a strong pro-Russian element. Romania less so, but economically they had far more in common than elsewhere. Now, as the economy today implodes everywhere, and we're coming into a qualitatively new era, for better or for worse, hopefully the EU will come crashing down, because its existence is based on the defeat of nationalism in 1945. In fact, everything we suffer comes from the defeat of nationalism in 1945. But if it does come crashing down, it's going to be because of the spirit of this Montenegrin Highlanders, the Orthodox nationalists from the East. And the point of all of this on Montenegro, was to give a brief history and ideological foundation as to what this kind of rebellion could be. I spent a lot of time talking about how the ideological foundation, these saints, these bishops who were rulers of Montenegro, have nothing in common with the well-fed liberal bishops, even of traditional jurisdictions. Like, you know, these guys are often just as bad. If they talk about something other than ecumenism, they're no different than anybody else. So the Montenegrin case is something that deserves even more attention. They show that even a handful of people, if the conditions are right and the tradition is proper, and they have the strong cohesion based on, of course, the language and religion, they can't be defeated. Now, that's the end of the Montenegrin thing. I have a few more minutes here. And what really bothers me, I want to mention a few things about our present situation. In early May, there was a report from the Institute of Policy Studies. Now, of course, we all know that tens of millions of Americans have lost their jobs. But I think only a few of us know that the wealthy have seen, just in the first 2 weeks of the lockdown, $282 billion added to their fortune in just 23 days. So, 3 weeks of the lockdown. We're talking about a soon-to-collapse economy. 40% collapse by the middle of the summer. And yet, this tiny group of liberal elitists are seeing their wealth go through the roof. Something that the fiscal conservative idiots don't acknowledge, because they live in a fantasy world. Between 1980 and 2020, the tax obligations of America's billionaires, if you measure it as a percentage of the wealth that they hold, went down by 80%. So in 30 years, the last 30 years, billionaire wealth has soared by over 1,100%. There is no median household wealth increase at all. I mean, the claim is 5%, but that's below inflation and way below their debt servicing. So it's a net decrease. Now, when you talk about the American economy, you have to talk about gender. Because over the last 10 years, women have done very, very well. Especially if they have a college education. They out-earn men. They outperform men. Not because they're better, but because they get, especially if they're attractive, they get what they want. We all know this. We've all seen it, whether we want to admit it or not. Women out-earn men. And they are, you know, pretty much guaranteed a good job if they have a college education. Men are suffering. So even if you say that median household income has gone up by 5% over the last 30 years, which is ridiculous, which is nothing, which is a decrease, given debt service and the cost of living and everything else, you have to realize that you have to separate that by gender. Without gender, that doesn't make any sense. You can't talk about economic statistics, really. And we talked about this, you know, as far as the Montenegrin thing is concerned, we talked about what oligarchy does. The minute modernity comes into a society, it introduces money. The standardization introduces classes. It unleashes passions that normally didn't have an outlet. It creates factions based on something other than, ethical concerns or ideological concerns. It's now purely financial. Debt becomes a weapon. All of a sudden, you have police and prisons. You know, societies up until modernity never had those things. And as always, modernity and this kind of system has to be imposed by force. We're talking about, you know, what doesn't matter where we're talking about. The nature of oligarchy is such that wherever they go, I mean, they're liberal by definition because they need a liberal system to function. In a national system or any other system, they would have no right to have them. But they haven't earned this. But you can't possibly earn billions of dollars. If the guy who cures cancer, of course, he won't be curing cancer by himself. Even that doesn't work. It's not possible. Total wealth held by America's billionaires now is $3 trillion. But in 1990, the total wealth held by American billionaers was roughly $240 billion. That's not that long ago. Now, remember, these figures are only what they report. This is way low. I mean, they don't have to report anything they don't want to. But the super wealthy has gained more wealth in the first 3 weeks of the lockdown than they made total prior to 1980. One of the things that the neocons and the fiscal idiots do is they talk about socialism. They don't know what it is, but they know they don't like it. And they talk about socialism in order to blunt the impact of those figures. Just three people, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett. Those three individuals own as much wealth as the bottom half of all American households put together. The fact is so overwhelming that it often doesn't have any real impact. We live in an oligarchy. Now, what's the relevance here? It's relevant what we've been talking about for the last 4 weeks in Montenegro, because the minute this group moves in, you can't have an oligarchy when you don't have a modern system. You can't have an oligarchy without monetization and standardization and globalization, even if it's just, you know, continent-wide. Oligarchy creates ideology. It creates standardization, which means you get prisons and police for the very first time. You have political parties. You have these divisions. You have people who take a political position because it suits their financial interests. And it's hilarious to read people today talking about America. They've just discovered. You have economists who've been working for 40 years, suddenly just discovered that America's an oligarchy. It wasn't that long ago where the word oligarchy was not permitted. And they can't believe that the super rich have captured power everywhere. And guys like Alan Glade from Center for Research on Globalization talk about this like it's a revelation to them. If you guys remember a few years ago, you kind of wonder these rioters, these movements, where they get their money. Just a few years ago, Buffett and Gates bought up dozens and dozens of charities. No one ever said who it was. They just said charities, and everyone's supposed to be happy about that, giving billions of dollars away. Well, all it really did was shield all that money from taxes, and they bought all these organizations. And the press went wild. I think it was back in 2008 or so. And the media, of course, always doing their bidding, acted like this is they've suddenly discovered, you know, their compassionate side. But of course, the reality is, because none of these people were paying any taxes, social programs, which were necessary, were crippled. A large drop in living standards, especially for white men, even to the point of dropping in life expectancy and increase in suicide. And you don't see this drop outside a major war or famine. No one really believes that kids are going to be better than they. And of course, they're right. And statistics, you know, they're only as good as the press who bothers to report them. And of course, the press doesn't report these things. They interpret these things for you. See, here's what happens. And I'm seeing this all over the place, and it's particularly irritating. I'm plagiarized every day. Most of you know who I'm talking about. There's a group of people who made a living on this. But more broadly speaking, mainstream writers watch and listen and read guys like me every day. And the reason they do it is because at that level, you know, they're working with oligarchs all the time. They work for them. They start thinking like them. Just like oligarchs steal money that they don't earn, these people steal ideas that they don't make. They'll read someone like, you know, Roberts or me or Hoffman. They'll see how the idea, I'll do all the work, do all the spade work, do all the digging, all the statistics, all the translate, whatever you need. And they'll see how it plays out over time. Is it true? Are people catching on this? Then what they'll do is they'll take the idea, and then because they're far more powerful, will then present it like it's theirs. That they just discovered this. This is the case with 9/11 stuff, the war in Syria, even things like the Tsar Nicholas execution, the fake killing of Osama bin Laden, the ISIS charade, even the Ukrainian situation. Back when this was actually an issue, you know, people like me were condemned and threatened. But they were watching very carefully. As I do all the work, people like me do all the work, then some idiot from Fox News goes and steals it. And claims it as their own. For some reason, I don't know, I don't get cited. Just an oversight, I guess. Well, that's the, you know, academic version or the journalistic version of what billionaires do financially. But where did this money go? And we're talking about oligarchy. We're talking about how oligarchy functions. Whether it be, I don't care if you're talking about Southeastern Europe or the riots in the cities. Oligarchy is based on, of course, the rule of money, the rule of standardization and quantity, but the control of information under the guise of free information. So what happens? Your typical Republican, you know, constitutionalist idiot thinks that the only people who can, you know, tyrannize over anybody are governments. And they refer to governments like a unitary thing. But that's not how power functions in the West. So what are the charities, so-called, that these guys, especially Gates and Buffett, bought those, all those years ago? Well, Gates donated $9 million to the British Guardian newspaper, $3 million to NBC, $4.5 million to NPR, $1 million to Al Jazeera, $49 million to BBC, and of course, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. Strange how this really wasn't a big issue, since the people who would make it an issue are these very people now. These are the charities that the press had reported worth billions of dollars from these people, and they're still being praised for their embrace of compassion and love for their fellow man. And I remember the puff pieces like it was yesterday. The irrational system, I mean, oligarchy is irrational. It's based not on production, it's based on the stealing of resources, asset stripping in essence. But the present crop of academics and journalists and the fake, you know, news junkies, idiots talking like they know something, they don't have the vocabulary to even describe what this is. This system has consequences. So, for example, the Federal Reserve expanded its balance sheet. So you bail out companies, it means you buy up the distressed assets. This is really essentially what the bailout is. So now the Fed, which is just saying this is the banking elites, the same group of people, found itself now owning securities that makes them vulnerable. I mean, ultimately what happens is these guys have sucked out the value of this capital. And through risky investments made them very vulnerable. And now this is now the taxpayer will take care of it, buy it out, and they don't have to worry about it. So that meant, ultimately, and Paul Craig Roberts and Ron Paul and a few others came out and said, right, you know, the lockdown was a week old and the Fed announced it would begin to purchase Treasury securities without any limit whatsoever. In other words, the elites took the profit from American debt and American collapse, and they could shift the burden when everything goes south. The problem is, journalists don't know how to describe this. They don't have the you know, they're used to the simply standardized language that they create themselves and that they use over and over again. That's not descriptive. It has nothing to do with reality. This is marketing. But this phenomenon is simply beyond them. Liberalism is so simplistic and naive. It can't describe any of this stuff. It has no idea. It's totally unsuited for a crisis like this. I want to close by saying, and we've been all over the place today because I wanted to finish up the Montenegro stuff. But of course, given what's happened over the last 48 hours, all of a sudden all this chaos has forced me to change everything up. I'll end by saying simply how the press is tightly controlled. The word depression, referring to economics, was unofficially banned. You simply couldn't use it. Unless you were talking about 1929, you couldn't use it. They would say stupid things like the Great Recession of 2008, something stupid like that, because you couldn't use the word. The word was frightening to people, and if they saw when they're in a depression, they'd pull their money out of banks. This is what the press does. You know, they don't really know, but they know what power is and what to do. I was one of the few people to talk about that the U.S. was in a depression since 2008. I had papers going all the way back saying this. There was no recovery. Now, as I said before, mainstream writers are going through all this stuff and now making the exact same arguments over the last couple months. Suddenly, they've discovered that the American economy had been in the brink of total disaster years before the virus came around so they could blame it all on it. and I've mentioned elsewhere, you know, Fitch Ratings Agency, highly politicized. You know, they say world GDP is going to fall 4% in 2020 globally. You know, unprecedented. What happened in 2008, 2009, this is going to be twice as severe. So a decline in GDP essentially comes down to almost $3 trillion in global income levels relative to last year, or almost $5 trillion relative to the pre-virus expectations of what was supposed to happen. Now, this is the Fitch agency talking. This is a group that's meant to analyze and judge the creditworthiness of securities. So when they say something like this, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I said this time last year that the American press, especially last summer, all of a sudden went crazy talking about this record-breaking recovery and how healthy the economy was. The Guardian ran the headline, "Unusual U.S. Economic Recovery." Now it's longest in history, June 12th. The Financial Times, "The record-breaking U.S. economy recovering in charts," in July 4th, 2019. And the CNBC, this airhead, Elizabeth Schultz, "For the first time in history, the U.S. economy has started and ended a decade without a recession." This is just a handful. This is what they were saying a year ago. Now, these very same people now are saying that this contrived crisis shows how shallow and brittle and unstable the economic foundations of the system are. These are the same people that were reporting how wonderful everything was, really just a few months ago. The CNBC thing was in December. They were saying right up until February that the economy has never been better. But the system is based on debt. But I've been trying to say, whether it be Serbia, Montenegro, Ukraine, Russia, wherever, even China, whatever I talk about, modernity means monetization, which means rule by debt. What's happened, especially over the last few years, the so-called economic recovery, and these guys knew this at the time, is just ridiculously low interest rates, massive rise in debt, both public and private, and a massive increase, of course, in oligarchy or social inequality. Now, the guys who were saying, you know, this time last year the economy is doing well, they weren't ignorant of this. They were aware of it. So now, all of a sudden, they're talking about how they always knew that the economy was brittle and a lot of trouble and it was on the verge. All economists functioning knew that the economy was nearing collapse in 2010. I was the only one who was saying it, me and a few others. Paul Craig Roberts. A handful of others. But the only thing that regime learned from 2008 was that you can bail out the system without consequences. You can force people whose homes you just foreclosed on to pay you to rescue you from your own irrationality. That's what they've learned. Trillions are being printed at the stroke of a pen, but since there's no production, you're going to have massive inflation. There's simply no other way around it. There is no middle class. Middle class is based entirely on debt. Given the fact that they're massively indebted, you can't say they own anything because they owe more than they allegedly own. And what they owe by debt anyway. So now you have the very wealthy and you have everyone else. I predicted, as I said before, I predicted in April that the regime is going to create a racial incident so that they then can get everyone talking about something other than economics. The use of public funds, the total takeover of the economy, the destruction of small businesses is deliberate. And the Fed is helping them do it. We've been through this at length. And this has really been the whole point of everything. Everything I've been talking about since I was a teenager. This is what modernity is. This is not an anomaly. This is not strange. This is not a mistake. This is inherent to the nature of the system. Just like modernity leads to post-modernity, capitalism leads to oligarchy, leads to almost acidic rule of an oligarch who now, oligarchy usually is secret, now it's out in the open. That's why the racial violence is here. Anyway, I'll talk to you next time, everybody. Thank you for listening, as always. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.